Well, I mean, I hope that you had a chance to.
I have indeed.
Would you like to comment?
Yes. And thank you for drawing this evidence to my attention. I hadn't seen it before. I think I believe it came in late. I believe I reviewed all the other evidence. So Mr. Wells' submission is mainly to do with Jack's points and Mills and Millbrook, but the end on point 27, he looks at the subdivision guideline, and he starts by saying he doesn't have a problem with the text of the subdivision guideline. What is confusing is the visual representation of the example. And then he notes four or five shortcomings in this sense,
yes.
Which I've read through. I can address each one if you want, but really, I don't think they're the major shortcomings. So I think he's scoring a few points here. At the end of it, by saying that he'd like to see a revision to the graphic of the layout, which, you know, would probably be a good idea, possibly, but it's not a substandard graphic example that's been shown within the subdivision guideline. It's quite reasonable. He's picked up some detail points, and there's a couple of rear lots. There's not the daylighting of the reserve to the road, vehicle access road, it's pedestrian access mainly. And there's a couple of lots that go right through this two street frontages. These issues can be dealt with in design, in detailed design. So I don't think they're substantive shortcomings or faults, for example.
Thank you. Now there's one other question that I had for you. I wondered whether in the time that you've been down here and got to know the district, if you could point us to any subdivisions, particularly urban subdivisions, that you would consider have a high quality or excellent standard of design?
That's a good question. So I've been involved in a lot of the subdivisions for 25, 28 years, and I've worked on the master plan for Austin-Ball Point, which is, you know, the central government's model subdivision. I'm working with housing and development in several suburbs at the moment in Auckland. I think in comparison to the leading sort of benchmarks happening in the larger urban areas, the level of subdivision design here I can see is improving. And I look at some of the subdivisions in Wanaka that I'm perhaps most familiar with. In Peninsula Bay, I'm actually renting here at the moment, which I call. That's got a good layout in terms of connectivity, in terms of solid orientation, got linking walkways, cycleways, so wonderful community facility. It's a low density subdivision. Single use, so there's no retail or commercial there.
Yeah.
It doesn't break down to medium density or high density. It's a good example of low density. The plans that I've seen for North Lake show greater densification, a smaller lot size, still retaining some good fundamentals in terms of layout and facilities and detail. So I think overall we are seeing an improvement, and as we sort of touched on before, I think it's part driven by controls and planning regulations, but it's also part driven by market competition. And these developers are out there with their product selling it based on these positive attributes. And I note Northlake, which is probably the latest one out of block at the moment are selling land and house packages. That's quite competitive. So you've got the house, the built form is created with the landscape and the subdivision design. So I think there's a pretty good outcome. I think we're probably going to see more of that. Comments about the importance of lot design and book.
Relating to infrastructure matters to support deliberations on the subdivision chapter of the proposed district plan, CDP. The process of ensuring appropriate infrastructure provision for subdivision and land development in Queensland Lakes District is multi-layered. Consultation between applicants and the Queensland Lakes District Council, QLDC, officers often occurs prior to resource consent applications being lodged. At resource consent assessment stage, feasibility of servicing is assessed. If servicing is considered feasible, conditions of consent are imposed to require infrastructure to be designed to generally meet the standards outlined in the QLDC Land Development and Subdivision Code of Practice, the COP. Detailed engineering design is undertaken after consent is granted, and those designs are submitted, reviewed, and accepted if appropriate by the QLDC Resource Management Engineering Team prior to construction commencing. Construction of accepted infrastructure is then undertaken and regular inspections by QLDC officers is undertaken to ensure the infrastructure is developed in general accordance with the COP and accepted designs. I consider including objectives and provisions in the chapter requiring appropriate infrastructure provision in accordance with best practice is important to ensure that QLDC can place appropriate conditions on subdivision consents. This will result in appropriate infrastructure servicing land development in the district. Chapter 27 has notified and recommended, and the recommended revised chapter attached to the Section 42A report, in my view, achieves this. I consider the matters of control and discretion associated with the recommended control and restrictive discretionary rules are appropriate and will ensure QLDC can impose suitable conditions of consent related to the structure. In my opinion, the COP does not need to be, and indeed should not be, identified in the PDP subdivision chapter as a standard. And by implication does not need to be incorporated by reference. The COP is an ever-evolving document, and as industry best practice evolves, so does the COP to capture best practice standards. Including it in the rules will freeze in time the best practice standards that would be required to be adhered to when developing infrastructure solutions for land development. The result will be that in the future, for the life of the district plan, recognize evolving industry best practice will not be what is required to be provided by subdivision developers. The issue of outdated standards referred to in the rules in the district plan and subsequently creating complications as well as illustrated by the submission of Clark Fortune MacDonald, Rep 414. The submission refers to current issues with the use of NZS 4404 2004, an outdated standard in the operative district plan. While it may be arguable that this submission does not relate to the current deliberations of the subdivision chapter, and these deliberations may not be able to resolve the issue raised in the submission, it does show that reference to an engineering code that subsequently becomes outdated causes problems. In my opinion, while a control activity status for subdivision generally works in terms of infrastructure requirements, a restricted discretionary RDA status is preferred. In particular, a RDA status allows for QLDC allows QLDC discretion to decline substandard applications that have inappropriate road and vehicle access widths, among other infrastructure concerns. There are currently 36 different road categories in the COP, and these categories will evolve over time. having an RDA regime for subdivisions would allow QLEC to decline resource consents if inappropriate road limits are proposed, which would result in inadequate and unsafe road environments. As an example, if a road is proposed in a subdivision that is too narrow to meet anticipated traffic numbers or safety requirements, then imposing conditions to widen the road as a matter of control will result in the subdivision layout and lot configuration changing, potentially making the original consent and subdivision layout assessed impossible to exercise. This situation can be overcome if QLEC were able to decline consent through an RDA regime, maintaining discretion over servicing, roading, and access. This issue does not arise currently due to the requirement of the transport section, section 14, of the operative district plan to meet roading design standards. Otherwise, a restricted discretionary activity consent is required. However, I do not consider this as an effective solution going forward for the reasons discussed in paragraph 5 above. Finally, I understand that no technical evidence of infrastructure nature has been filed by submitters.
Mr. Wallace, I'd like to ask you some questions that relate to your wider experience at QLEC, including your time as a consent officer. Did you, in that time, deal with many subsequent consent applications?
Yes, I did.
Urban ones?
Yes, all the environments around the district.
Right. In the urban consent applications, and I may have missed something in, over the years, but were they generally lodged by surveyors or by planners?
I think a mixture of both, Commissioner.
Right.
Yeah, there were certainly a lot of applications lodged by surveyors and applications lodged by planning consultants.
And of those total, the urban ones, how many of them, in ballpark figures, I don't expect you to be able to enumerate, but you dealt with them so you have a feel for it, were straight controlled activity applications as opposed to requiring some sort of other consent because the standard wasn't reached?
As you said, difficult to come up with the numbers, but I would say a large majority were for other types of activities. So controlled activity status for subdivision plus other slight amendments triggering other rules which require them to be restricted discretionary activities.
Right, so in total, they, looking at it as a whole, was that due to the earthworks requirements or? I'm just trying to get a handle on it.
Yeah, earthworks in many cases would have been one of the reasons, but certainly it's difficult for me to recall what reasons there were, but I certainly don't recall a lot of these applications being simple, straight controlled activities because some other rules were potentially breached.
Yes, okay. Thank you. Now, in terms of infrastructure, when considering urban subdivisions, is it common, both from an infrastructure point of view and a planning point of view, to consider whether the development of adjacent land subsequently or in conjunction will be affected by this particular subdivision?
Yes, in a couple of ways. I think from an infrastructure perspective, the capacities of our systems are taken into consideration by a subdivider. They have to consider the subdivision of surrounding land dependent on the zoning of that land, and that works into the capacity models that are used for provision of infrastructure solutions.
Right. And with roading in particular, because I mean, obviously the size of changing the size of pipes doesn't necessarily change the subdivision layout, but presumably with roading, if that needed to be changed due to capacity, would that change the subdivision layout?
think historically it's quite different because we have a new code of practice that I believe has more roaming types than the previous codes. But if we're looking at a subdivision of zone that today, and that goes into a low density residential zone, for example, and there's other low density residential zone that would likely be access but sent access road, then we would ask for consideration of that when the subdivision is made.
And would that affect both the type of road and the location of the road potentially?
It may affect the size of the road reserve, but may not affect the actual formed road.
Right.
The road will be formed for the subdivision being proposed, and the width of the formed carriageway would be as per the numbers proposed. But we would want a sufficient road reserve or to allow that road to be extended if the other land was developed and accessed by that road.
And would you be seeking to have the road reserve extending to the edge of the land's boundary so that it could be accessed into the adjoining land?
Potentially. I think you have to look at what's actually been proposed, what other options there are for access to the other parcel of land. I think in a situation where the land would be essentially landlocked, if we didn't have a suitable solution, then that would give us more ways to require a wider road reserve. But if the surrounding land was accessible by another public road, then there'd be a fair argument to say we shouldn't have that wider road reserve.
And are there existing examples of subdivisions where access to the subdivision is limited because of the way former subdivisions have developed? I know from hearing the Brightsdale one that was slightly problematic and that there are only two points of access into that whole block, but I'm wondering if there are other circumstances in the district where that sort of thing is occurring or has occurred.
So if I understand correctly, are you saying that are there situations where we haven't created a wide enough road reserve for the development of subsequent land around the subdivision?
Or, yes, in the past.
That is, has happened, that's correct,
yes.
So we will have, in some cases, substandard width roads accessing land.
Are you able to tell us examples, perhaps?
Dealing with it right now that isn't lodged, so I'm not sure about how much detail I can go into about it, but certainly there's an example in Wanaka where some land has been accessed from Orchard Road, and there's a historic situation in relation to maintenance of trees of significance, to that community, so widening the road reserve is problematic in terms of removing those trees and providing for the solution for roading that's required, and we're in the middle of trying to understand how we can solve that issue. But that's a good example that shows you the road reserve width that's created under the previous subdivision won't be wide enough to cater for the land beyond that.
Can I ask a question? That's just an example here in Queenstown. Highview Terrace across to Andrews Place, across to Goldfield Heights, or across the top up there.
Yeah.
We've had problems with the connections, connecting roads up there.
Yeah, through subdivisions, I can't tell you any subdivisions I know of where we've had those access connections in terms of road widths. No, I don't know of any particular subdivisions that have been affected so far.
One follow-up to the line of questions the Chair was asking you, Mr. Wallace. Should I infer that in terms of road widths, there is not a simple formula that can be employed to arrive at a satisfactory road width that fits every situation?
That's correct. That's the problem.
And in terms of your paragraph 6.3, it's actually reading this Glasner's, I think hopefully it's the same, talking about policy 27.2.5.1 about potential rather than expected, and the context is a policy wording suggested by Mr. Bryce reflects potential traffic levels. Potential over what time frame, and how potential? How likely does it have to be? How possible should it be?
So I believe Mr. Bryce was referring to expected.
Yes, it was. If as written, it was expected, and he's suggesting potential, and you're agreeing with him. And so I'm asking, potential over what time frame? How in practice would you apply a policy talking about potential traffic levels?
Potential is linked to what's anticipated by district plan zoning. So there may be various reasons why an applicant could argue that something isn't expected to happen for a period of time. What we're creating these rules for is what's anticipated by the plan, as in, if you like, to give you an idea, I don't like using the terms of worst case scenario or best case scenario, depending on where you're sitting, in terms of the development potential. So it was an issue of semantics, really, when we had the discussion about the word expected versus potential. I think potential could be replaced with anticipated, and it would have the same effect.
Or anticipated over the life of the plan?
Yeah, anticipated by the district plan zoning.
And lastly, I want to talk to you about your point at 7.2 about flood attenuation.
Yes.
I was trying to, this is specific to Kiramoto. Can you explain to me first, in terms of this primary stormwater runoff, secondary runoff, understand your point that primary runoff is designed to achieve effectively no greater runoff than natural. What's the test for a satisfactory secondary runoff?
How do you mean the test for a satisfactory? Sorry, I don't understand.
Well, like, could it go anywhere?
Oh, we will, when we get to secondary runoff flow paths and applications, they'll be directed through studies that have been done into particular areas. And yes, they can go to various locations. Generally speaking, we're talking about roads, but it depends on the environment the subdivision is occurring in. There may well be land adjoining that's owned by the applicant where a secondary flow path would go to, and then infiltrate following that.
And how are the rules of the plan currently address that issue? Like that of the proposed plan, not the ODP, how the proposed plan?
Well, I think there is a discretion or control is maintained over stormwater in the proposed district plan. When we get applications, we'll understand what's happening with stormwater in terms of normal stormwater flow, 20-year events, and then secondary flow paths.
So that's an area of judgment for you and your team?
Yeah, we would get the secondary flow paths and judge whether they were appropriate in terms of where they were going.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Wallace.
Thank you.
Checking whether there's another question before you open this up. Would you have any questions? looking at the chapter 22, the earthworks chapter and the operative plan. There is a version I have, may not be the final version, but certainly the one that went to the council. It says it's permitted activity at earthworks associated with a subdivision conceived under Rule 15.220, and it doesn't go up to 15.220 in my version of the district plan, but that may have been something inserted. Is that a...
Where are you reading this, sorry?
Page 22-5. It's clause little e. And the list of permitted activities.
Well, one of the versions isn't correct. I'm not sure which one it is. I found 22.6 here. Yes. Your question in relation to that?
Well, the first question is the version of chapter 15 that I have doesn't have a 15.220, it only goes up to 15.2.19.
Yep.
So if something was added there, I'm wondering whether there was some sort of activity rule inserted into chapter 15 as part of that.
Not that I'm aware of, unfortunately, Commissioner.
But that might be an error.
May well be pointed to the fact that earthworks were assessed under a subdivision consent rather than separately under the earthworks rules.
It is, it's been inserted by the North Lake plan change. That's what that is. So the next question then is if you go on to the following page, there's discretionary activities, just bulk earthworks. Over 50,000 cubic metres. In your experience with urban subdivisions, at what scale do you get to that quantity of earthworks and get caught by that discretionary activity? Is it 20
right, flats?
Right, so it's very large.
I think it was 90,000 cubic metres of created Hendel's Hole, I suppose it was the colloquial name for it, and the land across the way was built up. I believe that was about 90,000.
What was that, sorry, to break?
The 5 miles above it.
Well, 5 miles is quite small, actually, isn't it? But it did have a lot of fill.
Yes, it had an awful lot of fill work done there for urban subdivision. I certainly wouldn't have come across any urban subdivision, I don't believe, with 50,000, with over 50,000 cubic metres.
So, then generally, then, the earthworks on most subdivisions would fall into restricted activity, restricted discretionary activity under those rules. Would that be a fair assessment? Just having looked at them quickly.
Yes, I believe that's correct.
Right. Yes. Thank you very much, Mr. Paulson.
Thank you.
Well, I thought what I'll do is just quickly read my brief summary and then table some additional information. So I've been engaged by the Queensland Lake Fisheries Council to provide Section 42A planning evidence on Chapter 27. The purpose of Chapter 27 is to ensure the subdivision is well designed, located in the appropriate area anticipated by the PDP, and with the appropriate infrastructure capacity for servicing and integrated transportation. A key change from the default control activity framework in the operative district plan was a fully discretionary activity framework in the PDP. 1,519 points of submission, both primary and further submissions, have been coded to Chapter 27. A significant number of submitted seek a variety of relief related to the default discretionary activity status under Note 5 Rule 2741. These submissions broadly seek the same relief, either being either retention of the existing control activity rule framework under the ODP or the replacement of the existing discretionary activity status under the Note 5 Rule 2741 with a new control activity status. While the planning evidence of submitted in support of a new control activity status have argued that a control activity framework can deliver effective urban design responses, ultimately a control activity status only allows QLDC to impose conditions over those methods of control. The evidence of Mr. Wallace reinforces that while a control activity status subdivision generally works in terms of infrastructure requirements, an RDA status allows QLDC discretion to decline substandard applications that have inappropriate road and vehicle access widths, among other infrastructure concerns. Further, the evidence from Mr. Faulkner considers that an RDA status will allow for required improvements in subdivision design and give greater surety of quality outcomes. A group of these witnesses and consider that an RDA status to be a more effective method in delivering good subdivision design outcomes for the district, in particular when QLDC officers are unsuccessful in persuading an applicant or their agent that subdivision does not otherwise achieve good subdivision design. A key concern raised in submitted planning evidence is that an RDA status will not improve certainty over a discretionary activity status. I note that consent risk and uncertainty linked with the same is a feature of existing ODP subdivision chapter, where the majority of subdivision applications advanced between 2009 to 2015 in the activity status where council could decline consent. I consider that the redrafted rule framework set out in my Section 42A report and further changes to these rules as set out in the Council's opening legal submissions in this hearing will offer greater certainty and a better respond to the concerns submitted. The most significant amendments to Chapter 27 provisions include inserting a controlled activity status in the PDP for certain subdivision activities, such as subdivision that is in accordance with a structural plan or spatial layout plan attached to the subdivision chapter, and boundary adjustments, excluding boundary adjustments within Arrowtown's urban boundary and within more sensitive areas of the district, which is addressed through redrafted Rule 27.5. Deletion of default discretionary activity status for subdivision under the modified Rule 27.4.1 in favour of an RDA status, particularly geared towards subdivision within rural living and urban zones. Amending a number of objectives to read more like outcome statements, and integrating a new policy and method to respond to reverse sensitivity effects associated with high voltage transmission corridors. As mentioned, the Council's opening submission set out my reviews on submitted evidence filed and where I agree to further changes. I'm happy to talk to those changes if that assists. Now, what I'd like to do, Chairman, Commissioner, is just explain why I've tabled this decision. So this was, this is a decision which I thought would be quite relevant to just draw to your attention. It's one of the most recent decisions that has been approved by Council. It was a larger scale subdivision of 40 odd lots and reserve land, etc., which did raise a number of urban design issues. And the decision talks about some of the issues that were raised, but also supported with an independent urban design assessment. Now, ultimately, the subdivision was a controlled activity and was an RDA with the earthworks provisions. But the reason why I've tabled this is that it signals, in my mind, that the Council was going through many different examples where they faced challenges to overcome design-related concerns with subdivision throughout the district. In this case, the urban design consultant was recommending changes that ultimately would have resulted in quite significant costs, and on balance, the reporting officer, and I'll direct you to that commentary under paragraph 4.2 on page 3 of this decision. Ultimately, the urban design officer was recommending a number of changes whereby the reporting officer considered those and then on balance made a call that the effects associated with not amending the design were less than minor. In situations where you're dealing with a controlled activity status, that may not always be the case. And I myself have, as a processing planner for the council over the years, and most recently with the Shadow Park subdivision in Frankton, which is the subdivision that was created to house the new industrial zone around the Mitre 10 packing site. That was consented, I think, 18 months ago, if not a little longer. And that was a very challenging subdivision in the sense that there was very detailed discussions with the applicant around access lots for large heavy goods vehicles, and being particularly challenging in the sense that the lots themselves at the time that the application was submitted were fairly small. They complied with the minimum lot size of subdivision, but practically speaking, it was going to be very challenging for the development to work had the applicant advanced under the current under the layout that had been proposed. So there were further amendments to the scheme, and over a number of months, agreement was reached with additional information being provided by the applicant. That is one example, most recent that I've been involved with, where subdivision design went around in circles for many months before agreement could be reached with council officers and the decision ultimately approved. In terms of, there is another piece of paper, an email that I've swiped at the table. It is from the consultant, Mr. Scott, for Land Information New Zealand, submitted 661. In my section 42A report, I list a number of submission points at paragraph 4.4, which are to be deferred for rezoning. And so this particular submitter forms part of that deferred list for rezoning. So Land Information New Zealand was a submitter seeking a rezoning of a piece of land, and when I was preparing the Excel summary of submissions, for some reason this particular submission point was not carried through in the collective list of deferred submissions. So I'd just like to add that to that list, if that is all right.
Which paragraph was that in?
So this is my 19th of July 42A, and it's paragraph 4.4. And the list of submitters A through to M. If this submitter could actually be added as new submitter M to that list.
While we're at it, Mr. Bryce, I didn't see Mark Wolf Park in that list. Should they be in there too?
This list here was specifically dealing with rezoning submissions that are seeking rezoning.
Or perhaps the Queenstown Park.
No. Queenstown Park has submission rules
to do with rezoning.
Could buy an option.
Yes, so they are submitted in this chapter.
Yes.
Yeah. So, Commissioner, sorry, just to clarify.
The reason I had intended to ask you this was because I read your introduction saying the relevant introductions specifically include and assumed that this was not meant to be exclusive.
No, it's not.
So that to admit that there may be others, but that the intent is that all submissions of this kind will be deferred.
Correct. Yes, you're right. That's correct. So that's a couple of matters in terms of tabling different material. Also, during the questions of other council staff, we have managed to rerun some figures to do with the percentage of consents that were issued between 2009 and 2015 that were referenced in the section 32 analysis to this chapter. I have not read Mr. Goldsmith's legal submissions, but I will do so to leave it. But he is correct, he has raised concerns about those numbers, including the rural general zone subdivision. And so what I will do, we will provide you with more detail, I will provide you with more detailed information setting out the percentage breakdown. But if you take in the following notes, I think it would be quite helpful, so we can talk to this if need be. For the rural general, of the 696 consents that were reviewed over that period of time, 297 were involving the rural general zone. Now, I'll provide you with a percentage breakdown if that's helpful for this.
We're not overly concerned with the rural general because they're all discretionary.
Okay. Well, let's talk about.
I think the point is the extent to which it skews the numbers.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So in terms of all other numbers, control control activity status, 37%. RDA, 16%. Discretionary, 22%. And non-compliant, 35%.
Sorry, just run through those. 37.
Control, 37. RDA, 16. Discretionary, 22. And non-compliant, 35. So those indicators will provide you with a more detailed breakdown of that. So what I've said is that
it would be helpful if, also if you could distinguish between urban and
the rural living
and the rural living too, because I think the reality is that it's urban areas that need to develop that we need to be really focused on, rather than the tiny pockets of rural living in the district.
Okay. Thank you.
I am almost certain that you will be back here tomorrow. And so maybe you may have the opportunity to actually type that up for us.
Yes.
With your further breakdown.
Yeah.
That's very helpful. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, before you start, can I just have one follow-up question?
Yes.
About the initial information? Mr. Bryce, you were telling us about the Mitre 10 and Packet Save, and I was busy trying to do two things at once, but I didn't catch the punchline. You said it was very challenging and it took many months, but what was the bottom line?
The bottom line was that the consent was approved, but the design had to be, the subdivision design had to be reconfigured to accommodate an acceptable design solution.
Was the consent overall controlled, or was it?
Well, this was a particularly complex subdivision in the sense that it employed the new Franklin design, so it was actually ultimately non-compliant. But if you removed all the strips of various earthwork plan changes, etc., it would have been a controlled activity. However, they were advancing the activity in a comprehensive whole, so it was a non-compliant activity. But just to expand upon that matter you asked Mr. Wallace about, the earthworks for that particular proposal was somewhere in the order of 47,000 cubic metres of earthworks. So probably singly one of the largest earthworks consents for a subdivision in that location. But still will trigger that 50,000 cubic metres.
No. Well, I may as well carry on with that theme. Is it your experience in dealing with these consents that with subdivision, other than the very small ones that were existing, boxes subdivided into, that invariably there are earthworks involved, and that the earthworks consent were an integral part of the entire proposal, or is that, am I misinformed on that?
No, they are normally involved in subdivision activity, but then not all subdivision activity, I mean, obviously the larger the subdivision, the more likely you are to trigger the earthworks provisions. Smaller infill subdivision is less likely to be an issue with earthworks, based on that. Fairly larger scale greenfield subdivision or brownfield subdivision in the urban areas is more likely to trigger those requirements.
Now you'll have to bear with me because I'd already written my comments on the 29th of June version of your proposed rules things, and rather than transcribe them onto the new set and print a whole lot out again, I'm going to go with that version. But I'll give you the section numbers, which won't have changed, will they?
I don't think so.
No.
And just bear with me, I do apologise for the lack of detailed cross-referencing. I do realise it would have been very difficult to go back through and actually try and reconfigure exactly where some of these provisions have been relocated to. So, apologies for that.
No, that's okay. We were hoping by our minute that other witnesses would get the hint, but they don't seem to have. Just in 27.1,
the actual provision, sir?
Yeah, the statement, yes. I'll take you through this first and then I'll go to your section 42 main report.
Mr. Chair, in the unlikely event you're going to miss one, can I chip in?
Yes. That may speed things up. I just want to be clear on the fourth paragraph there, where it commences, good urban design will be encouraged by the use of the code of practice, etc. Should, now that the intention is that the code of practice not be incorporated in the plan, but the design guidelines are, should the purpose clarify that? Would it be helpful for users, do you think?
I think it probably would, sir. I'm reasonably comfortable if the code of practice was referred to in the purpose statement. I think we talked about that earlier.
Yes.
But I do think it would be helpful to actually expand upon or add a sentence as to the intent of the code of practice and where it fits in relation to decision making or ease of administration and plan user.
Could you then suggest such a sentence for us in due course, please?
I will do so.
Now the next paragraph, it says where except where specific provisions are provided to assess subdivision, such as rural Gibson and the rural lifestyle zones. And I'm just wondering where these specific provisions are. And I realise, Mr. Bryce, that you have come as a consultant to deal with this chapter, not the entire plan.
Yes.
And you may want to come back to me in the morning on that one, if you had a chance perhaps to discuss it with Mr. Barr. I'm just not sure that the other parts of the plan fulfil that expectation.
Yes, the intent of this chapter is to fulfill that obligation.
Well, if it is to the intent of this chapter, then we need to make sure that they're there. Yes.
That's right.
They're just turning now to the first objective, 27.2.1. Do you think that create is the appropriate word there? I was just wondering whether enable might be a better way of phrasing it. Subdivision doesn't actually, other than creating the layout, it doesn't create the quality environment on its own.
So, well, it can do so through a condition of consent.
Well, yes.
You can specify lots that are specifically set aside for ecological enhancement, like the margins.
So but it doesn't create the setback requirements. I mean, a lot of the urban design problems that were identified in the Boffin Miskell report were the buildings were set too far back from the road.
Yes,
that wasn't the subdivision's fault, that was the zoning rules.
That's exactly right. Yes.
And that's why I'm wondering whether creators are giving too much to subdivision when it's actually a holistic approach.
That's right. Well, I mean, that comes back to the issue that we'll no doubt talk about shortly about structure plans. I think it's important not just simply to look at structure plans as a plan itself, but the overall framework that supports structure plans as well. So.
Yes.
I mean, well, I'm reasonably comfortable with the wording. So your preferred wording, or your possible alternative wording was?
I just wanted to enable it quite there, and again, I'm happy for you to reflect on that.
Yes, I will. Good, thank you.
Policy 27211.
Before you rock on, while I've still got the page open of that objective, my query is the word appropriate on the third line surplus to requirements? If it was fit for purpose, is there any basis on which it would be inappropriate?
That's fine. That's what I was going to ask a question.
Oh, sorry.
What's that?
Apologies, Mr.
You
Chair.
You can answer both parts at the same time, or I'll tell you my part. You've deleted design at the end of that policy. That's a typo.
That is a typo, yes.
Yeah. So
and apologies, sir, I should have actually corrected that. It should actually be leave-in, please. Innovative design is quite an important part of that policy.
And then we return to appropriate standard. Should it be so broad, or should we have a little bit more direction on the policy?
Well, I think you could apply, given the fact that you've got the code of practice which has been deleted. Clearly, the code envisages a more stronger outcomes than appropriate standard.
Well, is it more standard that is appropriate for the purpose?
Yes.
In other words, you've used appropriate twice effectively by having appropriate standard fit for purpose.
Design that is fit for purpose. You could actually remove that reference to appropriate standards you need to construct and design and it's fit for purpose.
Okay.
I will have a look at that, that policy for that.
Grammatical, which I'll just fix. This is dealing with boundary adjustments. I'm just not sure, undertaken only for ownership purposes, do you think that really expresses the rationale? And all subdivision is taken for ownership purposes.
Mm. boundary adjustments may not necessarily be purely based on ownership purposes.
Mm.
It could be advanced for any number of issues or reasons.
It doesn't matter what the purpose for which it's advanced, should the focus be on the effect of it being advanced?
That's right, yes.
Mm.
Well, what I'd like you to think about when you're thinking about how to deal with Mr. Bryce is that the issue of boundary adjustments on the face of it is quite simple. But I've had a hearing in this district where through boundary adjustments made in previous subdivisions and boundary adjustment that didn't commence as a boundary adjustment, it commenced as the creation of four lots, and because one of them was problematic, the applicant decided that he would make lot number four a boundary adjustment by amalgamating it with another site, but under the operative plan is, I think, is permitted activity, but didn't require consent. And subsequently, and the other site was some distance away, I think it was 1.5 kilometres. And then subsequently came back and sought for the amalgamation condition to be removed, which of course requires subdivision consent. But the formation of the allotment through the boundary adjustment being permitted left you with an allotment on a plan which has seemed very strange that it was joined something 1.5 kilometres away, which led the council ultimately, in this particular case, after we refused consent, to settle it by consent order, and it was appealed. But it seems to me that those sorts of machinations, their boundary adjustments, are not leading to the outcomes that are desired by these provisions, but don't seem to be precluded.
I'm sure that there are many different examples that you could go through relating to boundary adjustments. It's very unusual to have titles. So these lots were not actually physically connected.
No, they weren't adjacent. They weren't immediately adjoining.
That's most unusual.
Mm.
So I'm not sure that I've heard of that before.
No, there doesn't seem to be anything in the law that says you can't amalgamate lots that aren't adjoining.
Mm.
And it ended up that way. And if that was a solution, then perhaps you might like to think that the rules should say they have to be adjoining.
Yes, Penny Graham was just saying about the potential to remedy that through changes to the rule.
Mm.
I mean, I think I may have actually heard about that. It's in the following
one.
Well,
that's quite recent.
Yeah, okay.
In the last 18 months or so.
Yeah. I think I recall another example in my time as civic court, and that may have been raised as well. But either way, that can be dealt with through changes to that control activity boundary adjustment rule, whereby you are actually stipulating that the lots that are being adjusted need to be immediately adjacent to each other.
Adjoining, respectively.
Adjoining.
If you might like to come back to us on that wording ultimately. That's just the loop that's in that policy. And the policy may not need to deal with it, but it just raised that question in my mind.
Before you go on, Mr. Chair, can I ask Mr. Bryce regarding 27212? I waited to make sure I wasn't getting in front of you.
Commissioner, sorry, can I just take quick notes down, otherwise I'll lose my train of thought?
Yes, sir.
I'm sorry, I do apologise. We're on page 2, I'm about half the page already of notes.
Yeah.
Take
27212, cross-referencing the subdivision design guidelines, and I have read in conjunction with your discussion of submissions of the concern, like from legal submissions for council, it seems to be clear or clearly accepted that in this context, this is referring to the subdivision guidelines as incorporated by a reference. Do you think it might be helpful to put a date on them, given that it's clear that it is a particular version?
Yes, I think that's a very good point. So, I mean, certainly the Arrowtown design guidelines are referenced as 2006 in the notified version of the plan, and I'm dealing with variation 1 to the proposed district plan, which has recently been notified, and it's replacing that 2006 version with 2016 with an updated guideline. So yes, I think that would be very helpful.
And in terms of that as a policy, do you think it's helpful for the policy to start support? Is that really what the policy course of action is, that the council will support something?
Well, I think the intent of the policy is to try and be as enabling as possible to encourage subdivision design, good subdivision design. So,
well, that might be a better way of phrasing it.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Yeah.
While we're talking line of wording, go to 27214. There are a lot of policies in this document that talk about the extent to which something is done, which I would read as an assessment criteria rather than a policy. Is that really what you mean?
Well, there have been in some instances the wording is like an assessment criteria, but
well, turn around. What's the course of action that this policy seeks to achieve?
The course of action is essentially to guide submitters away from, this is the way that I originally read it, was to ensure that applicants were submitted, applicants and developers were according to the minimum lot sizes. And in the event that they didn't, this is the scenario that you'd have to consider.
Think about saying that, because it doesn't at the moment.
Yeah, okay. Discouraging non-compliance with minimum allotment size, but in the event that you don't comply, this is what you have to consider.
Indeed.
Now going down to policy 27223. I just think you've repeated location as a factor.
You
see,
locate open spaces in appropriate locations.
Yeah. I think that's the second option, just go home equipment that
they could use. Seems like they could be struck out.
The next one is really problematic. Policy 224. And the beginning of the policy, I'm just wondering whether it's the connections is to be well integrated, or are they to be good and integrated? Please, it's not just me.
Good and integrated connection. You could reconfigure that policy so that it's achieved a better policy meaning.
It's better integration, you mean?
Yes.
Good, because there's a couple of other things that when you're looking at it, you can deal with. There's too many ands in it.
It's a very wordy policy.
And I'm not sure that the connections... I'm not sure that you need and trail connections. It seems unnecessarily doubling up. If you're talking about connections being the critical part and accessibility, I'm not sure that you need to then say trails and trail connections.
Mm-hmm. My contribution is to ask, step back and say, will all subdivisions have all of these things? Or is this a statement of what you are aspiring to? At the moment it's written in a very conclusory manner.
And it's catch-all, it's trying to encompass all possible variations of what could occur in the subdivision.
Go ahead. This comes back to the chair's point, with everything connected with and. It's going to do all of these things.
You might like to think about whether it's something that could have some bullet points in it.
I was just thinking about that.
Yeah, make it more logical.
Fit down. Just for my information, do you prefer bullet points or do you like Roman numeral?
Well, I think ultimately, from a user's point of view, Roman numerals are better because the decision maker can refer to the particular part more readily. Mm-hmm. Third bullet point is always a difficult thing to write, and either as a witness or as a decision maker.
And it's worse the 15th.
Well, especially if you're having to refer to many different policies,
yes,
all which have bullet points in them.
Mm. Yeah. A numbered list are much better.
Okay. So
think about Mr. Bryce, if you were writing evidence on this in 5 years' time. The other question I've got with this set of policies, and it seems to be the only place where it is, there doesn't seem to be, and I may have missed it, but maybe hidden amongst it, but there don't seem to be any policies encouraging multi-unit subdivisions, such as apartments.
Or suites or titling, for example.
Well, however it's done, there doesn't seem to be anything that's encouraging the multi-unit arrangements that you get with higher density.
Mm-hmm.
is you could read the policy framework as more applicable to greenfield or larger scale subdivision activity.
Mm. A good 1970s subdivision is provided for.
I would think
with better design.
I was only born in 71, so. But yes.
I don't know whether there's scope or not, but I'd appreciate it if you could think about an appropriate policy, because I think it's given that there is a bit of attention to high and medium density in the plan, I think we would have to recommend inclusion of something.
In this district, cross-leasing is not really a preferred method of...
I don't think it should be preferred in any district, to be quite frank.
I started my planning career on the North Shore of Auckland, where cross-lease was a prevalent subdivision.
I predated you by some years in administering subdivision in Devonport. Cross-leasing was a blight in the district.
Yeah. I'm not sure how it's dealt with now, probably still retained, but so it's more unititling that you're thinking about.
I don't think we need to specify the mechanism. The mechanism is something for the rules, and I'll get to that when we get to the rules. But I think the policy, there should be some policy encouragement for subdivision in the multi-unit situation.
Next one, Mr. Bryce. I read 27.225, 226, and was asking myself what the difference is between them, because there seem to be a significant level of overlap, if not entire duplication.
So I think for efficiency purposes, they could be combined quite clearly.
Well, the only, as I read it, the only additional feature of 225 is that it talks about reducing vehicle dependence, which is the end result. If you've done a good job of creating and utilising pedestrian cycle connections.
Mm.
And my second point, the next one, 227, while of course innovative subdivision design is good, is innovative required in that context? Boring subdivision that achieved the same result might be equally acceptable.
I don't think it hurts to have it there. Ultimately you've got policy 27.2.1.1 that refers to innovation, so it's already in the policy framework.
I suppose my question is, do you need innovation for innovation's sake if you can achieve the objective without doing it? My concern is it potentially it adds costs if everyone's trying to reinvent the wheel and find new things to do the same things.
Mm.
Well, is it the other way to look at it, Mr. Bryce, that it enables those people who do come up with innovative designs to have some policy basis, and it doesn't fit the standard check the boxes type situation?
I think for subdivision you should always have a guiding policy that refers to encouraging innovation, because as you heard from the Council's Urban Design witness, Swasna,
urban design and subdivision are interrelated and they are evolving over time through good practice. And so I think it's important to have either a policy level or a point of view of higher policies reference to innovation. I don't think you have to have it repeated right through your policy framework, however.
Well, on the basis that the inference I draw is clear that the chair didn't agree with me.
You're looking at a different way, aren't you?
my alternative suggestion, because the point's a fair one, is that you insert another adjective and say that better responds. Because that's what you're trying to do. You're trying to get better answers rather than just the same old thing. That's another thought.
You could simply have the wording encourage subdivision design. You don't have to have innovation because there's already a policy embedded within the previous section that talks about innovation and innovative design. Indeed, so policy 27.2.1.1 refers to it specifically. So it's not like if you're removing innovation under policy 27.2.2, it's going to dampen down the outcome. I was reasonably comfortable with it being there. Here's the reason why. I didn't seem to amend it, and no submitters appear to have saw changes to it.
Well, that's a good answer.
We got there in the end.
Now, my next question is on 27.2.3.2.
You go, John.
Policy 27.2.3.2 and Little Roman 3 is unless the right, I'm just wondering whether it should be except where, so that it's an exceptional situation, is quite explicit.
Except where this is not practical.
Mm.
Yes, I agree with that, Wiggins.
Now I go to 27.2.5.9.
I've got 27.2.4.4. This is a point you discuss in your report. I think I've read it. Basically, my question is, what's unacceptable loss?
Yes, well, I think the issue was raised by Marshall's Clark, I think it was. Well, one of the submitters, I can go to my 42A to look at that. But the issue that was raised is that it's clearly open to interpretation in terms of what it's not an easy to find term. But in saying that, when I look at this, I couldn't, for the life of me, consider an alternative wording that would otherwise water down the intent of the policy.
I suppose I found your, it's 18.100. The proposition I wanted to put to you, your response is the intent of the policy to avoid unacceptable loss is particularly strong and should be retained. The proposition I put to you is precisely because it's so strong, doesn't it need to be clear what it means? Like, I'm not saying that I have any great insight as to how it might be reworded, but can I ask you to think further on the subject?
Yes, I mean, the direction that I took initially was to change it to incremental loss, but then ultimately incremental loss, you're starting at a point where there is actually already loss that's occurred. So that's not the intent of the policy. The intent is to essentially protect.
Isn't the other problem with that policy is that you want to avoid the loss of archaeological sites, but it doesn't seem to want to avoid the loss of heritage sites, even though it commences by talking about both.
Correct. Yes.
Perhaps. Mr. Bryce, if you had a look at the policies in chapter 26, I'm not saying there are any that will answer the question directly as to unacceptable loss, but it might give you some inspiration.
Yes, well, thank you, sir, and I did actually look at the chapter as it was evolving, so I did give consideration to it. So. There wasn't any term unacceptable loss referenced in that chapter.
And while you're pondering that, 27247, I underline the word where appropriate. What would be the guidelines? What would be the criteria that would determine what was or was not appropriate?
This is 27257 or
247. 27247. Ensure that new subdivisions development recognises.
So that's 8.
So is it underlined 27248, ensure that new subdivision developments recognise
whatever. I think we know which one we're talking about.
Yeah.
It's the one with where appropriate next.
Yes, I see. Got there. So in the earlier version, that's 27248. 27.2.4.8.
Awesome. And the issue is
how open-ended that is. Yes.
Stop 1. The point I was discussing with Mr. Wallace, how potential is potential. His answer was over the anticipated over the life of the plan. Are you comfortable with that kind of a?
Yes, I did converse with the engineering team about that, and actually went through, and I think I even referenced it in the 42A report itself, linking back to some terminology that's referred to in the code of practice. So
I think Mr. Wallace also referred to as provided for by the zoning of the plan.
He did refer to that, yes.
That's right, so you're absolutely right. that before I put, that was the question I put to him, and his answer
yes.
was
the zoning
of the plan
yes.
rather than the time scale.
Yes.
He was more focused on the zone.
Would that be helpful, that one of those situations, rather than explaining the policy of footnote, clarification as to what potential meant by the system?
I think so. I think that would be, I mean, again, it's all about plan administration and visibility, so if an explanation can guide plan users, I think that would be a good outcome.
Mm-hmm.
Encouraging initiatives.
I'm really wondering how that policy can be applied on subdivision. It seems to me a land use policy.
Well, I think a subdivision can be forward-looking through consent notices or conditions of consent to encourage that type of outcome. Certainly, if you've got a policy framework in the plan or guidance that promotes recycling in a rural setting, and the applicant or their agent is trying to promote that outcome as well, then I think you can link it back to the subdivision through consent notices.
Are there equivalent provisions in the zones? If it's standing there alone, I'm just wondering whether it's supported elsewhere in the plan by what sort of design. Because consent notices, yes, and they really are imposing restrictions on the land uses that apply.
Mm.
And generally, when you're applying consent notices, you've got to look at what the zone provisions are to see what the land uses should be. And yes, it's part of the subdivision consent, but it's not a subdivision matter. I agree that it alleviates in some instances the need for infrastructure that would otherwise be required.
Yes. The only reason why I raised that is that I did a consent in Dunedin quite recently in the rural residential zone above Blueskin Bay, where a consent notice was carried through to that effect. And that was both promoted by the applicant and the planning agent, which was myself.
Mm.
So it's not unheard of. But I think that if it is a standalone policy and it's not supported in terms of the zone,
That was my concern.
So is that something that you've seen through your earlier hearing chapters with the rural residential or rural lifestyle that you recall?
I can't recall off the top of my head.
I have a lot to say there.
Yes.
The required version of the provisions.
I know that Commissioner Lawton would be quite enthusiastic to be in there.
like to hear it. But, you know, earlier in the we were discussing water literatures that you would use, and I would have thought that when you were going for a subdivision consent, you would need to state what your draw is going to be per lot, and if you can say that you're going to be using reusing grey water and taking that pressure off the infrastructure, then that surely would be part of the subdivision process.
Well, I believe that's a really good thing, but I think the intent of the policy is that it can be considered on a case-to-case basis, and so it shouldn't necessarily be discounted, because it does actually promote a good design outcome where you're actually thinking about future servicing requirements if you're in a water scarce catchment. And it may be a particular issue around some of the district-wide rural living and rural lifestyle zones.
I think, other than Macro Aurora, I think we are in a water-scarce environment. So, I mean, I'm not saying it's problematic, I just want to make sure that that's connected to the land uses.
Yeah.
One last question for the day from Commissioner Robinson.
27.2.5.11. I think in your 42A report you said this is not necessary, but it's a good signal, effectively. That's my paraphrase. Correct me if I'm wrong. The question for you is, given that, as you acknowledge, the development contribution policy is an LGA process, and that while I don't imagine the council will be changing its development contribution policy every 2 minutes, is it sensible for the district plan to lock in what is currently the council's 10-year plan development contribution policy under the LGA, where that could be reconsidered at any tick of the clock?
Well, I mean, you could argue exactly the same issue that I've raised with the integration of the fire service standards. If they do change, would then the inefficiencies of having to advance plan changes to update them. So, the same argument could be applied, as you've highlighted, to this policy and other policies that refer to the council's development contribution policy. I'm reasonably comfortable with the way that it sits in the plan at the moment, but at the same time, acknowledge that the policy is formulated under the Local Government Act, and therefore it doesn't necessarily need to be integrated in the district plan as it is. But my position is that I'm reasonably comfortable with it in there.
Would the policy make any difference, have any different effect, if it had a full stop after developers?
No, because I think the intent of the policy is to guide land users that there is development contributions.
Yes.
And I think as a plan user myself, as a consultant, as an administrator of this plan, I'm aware of it. Most planning professionals, subdividers, surveyors will be aware of the council's development contribution policy. I guess the issue is whether or not the general public is, and whether or not people would be caught out by it not being cross-referenced in the district plan.
But isn't the use of the development contribution mechanism a method?
It is a method, yes.
So, technically, the policy ends at developers, mm. and the method commences with use of development contributions. Mm. And, I mean, this plan doesn't seem to have included non-regulatory methods, which essentially that's what it is, though. It's a non-regulatory method.
Yes.
And that might be a more useful way of including it immediately preceding the rules or something to guide people.
As a knife.
Yes. Yeah. Something like that. Mm.
So what I'm hearing is that there doesn't appear to be objection to it being referenced in the district plan, but just in the way that it's context in the policy sense.
Yes, in the same way that the code of subdivision has that, from the same situation as the code of subdivision in reality, isn't it?
Yes. So it may be that there's benefit in cross referencing back in the at the front end of the chapter, drawing it to people's attention that development contributions are advanced in accordance with the council's policy.
About the third line, I would have thought.
Before we adjourn for the afternoon, present proposal is to reconvene at 10 unless anyone desires an earlier time. Scott, are you happy with 10? I think we should be finished, if not by lunchtime, it won't be long after that.
Yes, Norman, excuse me, more happy with 10 o'clock. I'm hoping to get on the last flight on. Sorry, I think my PC is after that.
You mean tonight or tomorrow?
No, the 3:55 tomorrow.
Ah, yes. I think you might be joined by Commissioner Robinson.
I'm taking a good finish. So, 10 o'clock.
Okay. All right, I'll adjourn until 10 a.m. tomorrow morning.